So last night, I talked a little bit about our topic for the weekend. This highly significant but rather mysterious text called the Heart Sutra. It's something we chant every time we do a puja. A lot of us know it off by heart. When we chant it, we probably have a really strong sense that it's saying something important. But if we were asked to say exactly what that something is, we might be a bit stumped. So, what is it all about? What is it all about? Well, I'd like to, as it were, sidle up to that. I'd like to sidle up to what it's all about by telling you a story. So, once upon a time, a very, very long time ago, there lived a truly exceptional man. He was so exceptional that the tradition said that that was the result of spiritual practice over many, many lifetimes, and this long process of growth culminated in a great breakthrough. He broke through to a different plane of being. He went through a sort of state change. He became a completely different sort of being, dwelling on a higher plane of existence from the rest of us, inhabiting a different dimension. And from that perspective of this higher plane of being, he saw that we normal humans have got it all wrong. We don't see reality as it is, and as a result, we blunder around in our lives, causing ourselves all sorts of suffering. A bit like a mature adult watching young children, we see that they get terribly upset if someone else takes their toy, or if something they were looking forward to is postponed, or if they don't get their own way, and there might be tears and sulks and fits of temper and tantrums. But an adult sees that what they're upset about is really not that important, not important at all. There's a bigger and truer perspective. But it goes beyond that, because what he saw from this higher dimension of being, he saw that there was something quite wonderful about the nature of things. Something that if we could see it, it would completely solve our problems, eliminate the dissatisfaction that drives us on to more and more suffering. So maybe another analogy for that is, it's a bit like the way a caterpillar turns into a butterfly. So, for its whole life, a caterpillar maybe burrows away as a grub inside some plant, seeing nothing but some green stuff in front of its nose. And then it pupates. And inside that pupa, its whole being is rearranged and it emerges as a butterfly. And it flies up into the sky and it sees this wonderful world of colour. And blue sky and bright sun and beautifully coloured flowers and distant horizons, which it had never imagined could have existed. And the butterfly just thinks back to existence as a grub and is filled with great compassion for the other poor grubs still burrowing away in their little green world. So, okay, the hero of our tale. He felt just this sort of compassion for all the people he had left behind in their usual state. But he saw that he could no more, ex they could no more, we could no more experience what he experiences than the caterpillar could imagine what it was like to be the butterfly. It had never seen any of that. If he tried to explain it in words, we would think we understood, but we wouldn't. To see the world in the way that saw the world, we would have to go through the same process of growth that he had gone through and the same transition that he had gone through. So the tradition tells us that he thought it would be impossible to help the people he had left behind. But then he had a vision. He saw all human beings as in different stages of a process of growth, which was symbolized by a lake of lotuses. So he saw that some of the lotuses were still stuck in the horrible gungy mud at the bottom of the lake. Some were part of the way up, but still in the dark, murky waters. Some could just about see the glimmer of sunlight above them, and some had actually come out of the water and were ready to open. So he saw that he couldn't communicate his vision of reality to people directly, but what he could do was help them, help us, to grow to the point where we could see it for ourselves. And I don't need to tell you that this exceptional man, of course, was Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, who became the Buddha. And what the Buddha offered us was mainly instructions on how to grow. The Dharma is principally a horticultural manual for the cultivation of lotuses. Not an attempt to describe what it's like to be a Buddha. Where the Buddha does try to communicate something about his vision of the nature of reality, he does that mainly through metaphors. And when he does use concepts, he makes it very clear that those concepts don't express the whole truth, that there is more to it than anything that he could express through words. So the truth he sees is beyond the realm of words and ideas. So when one of his most valued disciples said that he understood the Buddha's teaching of conditioned co-production, the Buddha replied, "Say not so, say not so." It's pointing to something deep beyond the realm of words. You can't understand it in that way. So the Buddha gave us methods. He gave us methods, ways to grow, means to an end, and he gave us metaphors that we shouldn't take seriously, and he gave us concepts and ideas that just point beyond themselves to a deeper truth. But over time, what seems to have happened is that more and more people focused on the methods in ends, as ends in themselves. They took the metaphors literally, and they mistook an understanding of the ideas for a direct perception of the reality that those ideas just pointed towards. It was as though someone had said, "There is a veil between you and reality. Here are some scissors you can cut the veil with." And people had gone, "Oh, scissors, wonderful, now I see it." Or as though he'd said, "If you climb up there, you will see the most amazing view. You will not believe the view you see from up there. Here's a ladder that you can use to climb up." And people had gone, "Oh, wonderful ladder, oh, wonderful ladder. Let's contemplate the ladder." Or it's as if he had given people a map. A map that showed the way to a wonderful place, and people studied the map, they meditated on the map, they argued about the detail on the map, but they never went anywhere. But of course, there were those who harked right back to the spirit behind the Buddha's original teaching, who wanted to point people past the methods, past the tools, past the words and ideas, not because there was anything wrong with those, they were incredibly useful, but because if we focus on them as ends in themselves, we get stuck. They wanted to point to the wonderful reality that is beyond all that, which we can only get an inkling of through our heart knowledge, through our intuition, our spiritual imagination, and our Shraddha, if you know what that is. I'll say a bit more about that later. But which we can never fully tie down with our words and our ideas. So the movement that started in that way, to get beyond that sort of literalism, became known as the Prajna Paramita tradition. Prajna means wisdom. Paramita, usually translated as perfection, so we often call it the perfection of wisdom. But paramita also means to the other side, beyond. Gone to the other shore. So Prajna Paramita could as well be translated as the wisdom of the beyond, or the wisdom that takes us beyond. And according to the great translator Edward Conza, there are 38 different Prajna Paramita sutras. And the Heart Sutra that we're exploring this weekend is meant to concentrate and crystallize the very heart of all of these different Prajna Paramita texts. Its full name is the Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra, the heart of the sutra, the discourse on the heart of perfect wisdom, or the discourse on the heart of the wisdom that goes beyond. And it summed up, it sums up a tradition that produced thousands of pages of text. So it's no wonder that it sometimes might seem a bit obscure to us. Because not only is it pointing to something beyond words and ideas, but it's also often pointing to a subject or a topic that's been argued about and explained in much more detail somewhere else in one of these other thousands of pages. So it's a reminder of something that we're supposed to be already familiar with. And then we come across it and it's a bit like a crossword puzzle in The Guardian or something. It's like, what? Okay, that's enough of an introduction. Let's look at the sutra. I'd like to look at the sutra itself. And in doing that, I'm often going to be using a different translation to the one we usually use, what we chant in the puja. That translation is designed for chanting, and it works very, very well for chanting, but it isn't always the most original and most accurate to the original Sanskrit. It sort of takes a bit of liberty sometimes to make a nice chant. I'll often be using a translation based on a translation of Edward Conser, the great translator Edward Conser. So in his translation, the sutra begins with a line that isn't there at all in the version we chant, which is Om Namo Bhagavachai Arya Pranya Paramitayai. Om, I bow to the wisdom of the beyond, the lovely, the holy. So the sutra starts with reverence. It starts and ends with reverence, as we'll see. It starts with us putting ourselves in an appropriate relationship with this reality that is completely beyond our usual understanding. Wondrous, radiant, inconceivable, full of positive qualities. So we start out by admitting that the truth reality is superior to us, approaching it with reverence and respect rather than trying to master it with our understanding. It's equivalent to admitting that we can't really understand it, not in the way that we usually understand. We can understand the scissors, we can understand the ladder, we can understand the map, but we can't understand what they are meant to reveal to us because we haven't had that experience. And when we understand something, we think we've sort of made ourselves superior to it. We talk about, I've mastered that discipline, I've mastered calculus or something like that. Well, you can't master the Pranya Paramita. It's our master, if anything. So in our version, that line, Om Namo Bhagavachai Arya Pranya Paramitayai, according to Conza, it could just as well be translated as Om, I bow to the lovely holy lady, Pranya Paramita. Because Pranya Paramita is also personalized as a female bodhisattva, and there's an icon of her on our shrine here in front. So it could just as well be seen as, apparently from the Sanskrit grammar, it could just as well be seen as us paying our respects to Pranya Paramita, to wisdom, as it could to us paying our respects to this figure. So maybe the first line is telling us that we should approach the truth behind this sutra with the same reverence we would feel if we were putting ourselves into the presence of a beautiful, wise goddess, not approaching some sort of impersonal knowledge. So our version, then we get into our version of the sutra. We chant the Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. But if we look at a bit of a more accurate translation from the Sanskrit, we see that there are some depths in those lines that aren't that obvious in the version we chant. So the Sanskrit goes, Arya Avalokiteshvaro Bodhisattva Gambirang Pranya Paramita Charyam Charamano, which means the holy Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was coursing in the deep wisdom of the beyond. That's the first part of that. The holy Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was coursing in the deep wisdom of the beyond. So for a start, we're introduced to Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And this is a sutra that's supposed to be about wisdom. So that maybe that's surprising. We often see those as quite different. So we might expect to be hearing this sutra from Manjugosha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, or of course from Pranyaparamita herself. Why isn't it Pranyaparamita who is speaking? But no, it's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And I think that makes an important point. The sutra is absolutely not about some cold intellectual understanding. It's pointing to an understanding that comes not from logic, but from the heart, from the spiritual intuition, from the imagination, from Shraddha. And the fact that it's Avalokiteshvara that's speaking also reminds us that you can't separate wisdom and compassion. They are absolutely two sides of the same coin. And we're told Avalokiteshvara is coursing in the deep wisdom of the beyond. Coursing in the deep wisdom of the beyond. So he's coursing, yes, he's coursing in the deep wisdom of the beyond, but at the same time, he's high up. He's deep and he's high up, looking down. Avalokiteshvara's name means the Lord who looks down. So he's coursing on a different plane, somewhere which is both deeper and higher than our normal state of being. And what he communicates to us comes from that plane. It comes from that plane. It doesn't come from our normal ideas of rational intellectual thought. It's an attempt to communicate from that state to our state. That's what the sutra is. We are dreaming, he's awake. And he has to talk to us, if you like, in the language of dreams. And then we get, he looked down and saw only the five skandhas. So he's coursing in the deep wisdom of the beyond. And he looks down and he sees only the five skandhas and that they are empty of own nature. That is Khonsa's translation. He saw only the five skandhas and that they are empty of own nature. So what he sees from this high state is that there are only the five skandhas and that they're empty of own being. The five skandhas, if you don't know about them, are form, feeling, perception, volitions, and consciousness. And I think we have to go into a little bit about the background to the skandhas here to understand what's being said, because the five skandhas were taught by the Buddha as a way of dividing up our experience of what we call a human being, dividing up our experience. He taught it as a meditation practice. He taught it mainly as a meditation practice to help practitioners deconstruct, if you like, their sense of having a separate, fixed, unitary self that they were somehow in charge of. So practitioners would look carefully at each aspect of their experience, physical form, feelings, and so on, and reflect, is this myself? Is this myself? Am I in control of it? Am I in control of it? It seems to happen of its own accord. Constantly changing, often doing things I don't like. Can I make it do what I want? No, my body just does what it wants. It gets older. I don't want it to get older. My feelings just do this and that. It often does things I don't like. In which case, how can each one of these be me? So the inevitable conclusion of this sort of meditation, this sort of reflection, is that there's nothing, we can't grab hold of anything that we can call the self. We can't grab hold of anything of the sort. What we call the self is really a bundle of constantly changing streams of experience. So the skandhas were taught as a meditation practice, a reflection practice, a way of loosening our sense of self. They were a tool, a method. In fact, they're just one way of dividing up the human experience. They're just one way of doing that. And Buddhists later came up with loads of other ways. We could say the skandhas are, in a sense, a rather arbitrary way of dividing the human being up to help us to see that we're not this unitary, independent entity. But as time passed, people started to think that this tool was the truth. It was the truth of things. They started to think that the scissors themselves were the answer. If the scanners of the scissors, they started to think that the scissors themselves were the answer, not what we could see when we used the scissors to cut through the veil. And where method becomes dogma in that way, it stops being useful and becomes part of the sort of prison that that traps us. So Avalokiteshvara sees, what he sees is that in one sense there are only the skandhas. In one sense, true, there are only the skandhas. There's no such thing as these fixed, isolated selves that we think we are. But at the same time, those very skandhas are empty of own being. The skandhas are no more real than the fixed selves that we use to deconstruct. No more real than the fixed selves that they were meant to help us escape from. Skandhas are also just mental categories, like the self. So, okay, Avalokiteshvara looks down, sees that the skandhas are, everything is only the skandhas, but the skandhas are empty of self-being. And then we come to two of the most famous lines in, I think, probably Buddhist scripture. Iha Sariputra Rupang Shunyata Shunyataiva Rupang. Here, Shariputra, form is emptiness, and that emptiness is form. When we chant our version, we forget about Sariputra. And we say, here then, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. But actually, Avalokiteshvara is talking to Shariputra, and Shariputra's presence here, it does have a significance, because poor Shariputra, I mean, he gets a lot of stick that he doesn't deserve. In later Buddhism, poor old Shariputra becomes the fall guy. There's one sutra in which the gods are raining flowers on everybody, and everybody's in delight, and Shariputra, they're sticking to his robe. And he's horrified because monks aren't supposed to decorate their robes. So he's constantly trying to get the flowers off his robe. So poor guy, he gets taken the mickey out of it. It's completely unfair. It's completely unfair. In the Buddha's time, Shariputra was renowned for his wisdom. But he came to represent, in later Buddhism, he somehow came to represent the approach to the Dharma that knows all the lists and the terms, knows all the rules, sticks to the rules, but mistakes the rules and the methods for ends in themselves, takes the metaphors literally, doesn't see beyond the words and the ideas to the truth that they point to. So form is the very first of the skandhas, and Avalokiteshvara is telling Shariputra that the skandhas he is supposed in their way of thinking, the skandhas that he's supposed to think of as the true description of reality, they're in just, in fact, arbitrary mental categories. But if we ignore poor old Shariputra and his completely unfair treatment at the hands of the Mahayana, we're left with those two really famous lines. Here then, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Two probably the most famous lines in Buddhist literature, packed with meaning. So first then, form is emptiness. Here then, form is emptiness. Here, on the level at which Avalokiteshvara is coursing, the appearances around us, the things and phenomena of this world, all of this lot, they're seen as emptiness, shunyata in Sanskrit. Shunyata is a huge word with lots of meanings. It's often grossly misunderstood. So the translator Edward Conza says it's the most misunderstood word in Buddhism. Most misunderstood word in Buddhism. Okay, so but let's unpack what it means. So firstly, it means that from Avalokiteshvara's plane of being, all this we see around us, all this stuff we see around us, all the forms we see are empty in the sense that they lack true selfhood. Svabhava shunya. Svabhava means essence. Shunya means empty. They don't have an essence. They don't exist as fixed entities, for a start. They're constantly changing. And they're not independent of other things. They're In fact, they're constantly influenced by a host of tradition, a host of conditions around them, are completely interwoven with everything around them. So they're not really separate from the world around them. The boundaries we draw around things to separate one thing from another are just based on our mental categories. This means they don't have what at the time was called real selfhood, svabhava, some sort of independent essential essence. And that applies to us, and it applies to all the phenomena of the world. All things are empty of independent self-nature. But as I've said, emptiness is often really, really misunderstood. That could all sound quite negative. But in fact, emptiness is a very bad word for emptiness. And the Buddha seems to point to this fact. There's a sutta in the Pali Canon called emptiness. All of this, incidentally, most of the Pranayaparamita, you can find in the Pali Canon if you look hard enough. It just seems to have got a bit ignored. But there's a sutta on emptiness. I think there are two suttas on emptiness in the Pali Canon. And in one of them, the Buddha says, through dwelling in emptiness, I now experience abundance. So through emptiness, you get fullness. Emptiness is full. It's full of good qualities. In other Pranayaparamita sutras, the Buddha tells us that that which is empty is infinite. That which is empty is blissful. That which is empty is deep, silent, peaceful. So all phenomena are infinite, deep, and blissful. So the word emptiness is telling us that things don't exist in the way that we usually think they exist. And we don't exist in the way that we usually think we exist. In fact, we and all things exist in a different way, which is much more mysterious. So rather than saying that all things are empty, it might be better to say that all things are mysterious, miraculous, beyond our comprehension, imbued with a beauty and meaning that's deeper than any of our ideas about them. And incidentally, I mean, so this word emptiness comes, and this whole analysis comes, causes some people to say, well, we don't have a self, which can get quite nihilistic. But of course, we do have a self. We just don't have a fixed, independent self. We do have a self that is constantly changing, hugely interconnected with the world around us, and that is far more interesting than being sort of stuck in some unchanging self. So this emptiness means that things don't have this separate, independent, fixed selfhood, but it also points to the fact that all of this we see around us, that we think of as so solid and so important, it's just insubstantial. It's insubstantial. It's Shakespeare's insubstantial pageant. And all these appearances will fade and leave not a rack behind. It all just flickers into existence and vanishes again immediately, like a film, moment by moment, constantly changing. It's traditionally likened to a magical illusion or a dream. So the constantly changing shapes we see around us are like the shapes we see in clouds, which look so solid, but when you get up to them, they're just mist and vapor. And the only reason we don't just fall through this landscape of vapor is because we're also part of it. That's what we are too. We're just part of this insubstantial play of clouds in the sky. For the scientifically minded, this cloudscape is the world as seen by quantum physics, for example, where everything just exists as a cloud of possibilities that crystallizes moment by moment when it's perceived. It's our perception of it that brings it into existence moment by moment. So a traditional verse tells us, so you should see all of this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a phantom and a dream. So on the one hand, emptiness tells us that the things we all see around us are deep and infinite. And on the other, that we should somehow take it lightly. We should somehow take it lightly. Sit light to the dramas it plays out. We should play within it. So the Pranyaparamita Sutras tell us that at the same time, we should take it very seriously indeed. We should take other people very seriously indeed. We should take trying to help other people to rid themselves of suffering very seriously indeed. We should take our own karmic career very seriously indeed. But our agendas within this play of clouds are not so serious. They're not so serious at all. We should sit light to it. We should care deeply and not care so much. And I should not care so much about losing my weight in my notes. Yeah, so this wonderful emptiness. So then the next line is, of course, we had form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. This wonderful emptiness is a quality of things. It's not some abstract reality. It's not some abstract reality that exists separately. It shines through the world. So we need to live and act here in the world of form and not try to vanish into some sort of spiritual ivory tower. We need to live and act here in the world, but seeing it as this magical spiritual place. Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva. And maybe this is linked to the bodhisattva idea. We don't try to vanish into nirvana, the absolute. We stay and work in the world of form. Having seen that form is emptiness, we return to the world seeing emptiness as form. We come back to the world, but in a completely new way. We're in the world, but not fully of it. And then, having said that form is only emptiness, emptiness only form, the Avalokiteshvara goes on to tell us that, of course, this is true of all the skandhas. It's true of all the skandhas, not just form. Here, Shariputra, it's true of form, feeling, thought, and choice. And all phenomena are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled, nor immaculate, not deficient or complete. So we say all things are by nature void. All things are by nature empty. They're not born or destroyed, they're not stained or pure, nor do they wax for wane, nax or wane. So nothing has independent existence. Nothing can really be said to come into being at any time, because in some way it sort of doesn't exist, or nothing can cease to be at any time. It doesn't exist independently. Similarly, nothing can be said to be intrinsically pure or intrinsically stained. And then having sort of, as it were, deconstructed the skandhas in that way, as a real description of reality, the sutra goes on to look at another of the ways that Buddhism sort of carved up the human experience into the senses and the sense fields. So no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, colour, sound, smell, etc. Well, here we get this rather confusing language, which I think can be very confusing, that expresses the fact that things don't have an essential fixed nature by saying that they don't exist at all. No eye, ear, nose. So in one sense, they don't exist, in the sense that they don't exist in the way we usually think of things existing. But of course they exist. Of course they exist. You know, pull my nose and I'm going to respond, you know. They exist. But they exist in a different way, just not the way we usually think. So then in the sutra, we get into some very difficult territory indeed. Because the sutra turns its attention to the very teachings of Buddhism. The ideas that many of us find so, so useful. No ignorance or end of it, nor all that comes of ignorance, no withering, no death, no end of them. Nor is there pain or cause of pain or cease in pain or noble path to lead from pain, not even wisdom to attain. Attainment to is emptiness. So this is a reference, no ignorance or end of it, is a reference to the 12 links of the chain of conditioned co-production. And nor is there pain or cause of pain or cease in pain or noble path to lead from pain is a reference to the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. So Avalokiteshvara takes two of the most important teachings of Buddhism, the two really crucial teachings of Buddhism, and says they don't really exist. They're empty too. They're shunyata. So this is getting into some pretty dangerous territory, actually, for us. Because if we understand what's being said here, if we misunderstand what's being said here, it can literally ruin our spiritual lives, if we misunderstand what this means. Okay, the teachings of the Dharma are not the wonderful reality that they're helping us to move towards. They're not what they're pointing, they're not the wonderful reality that they're pointing towards. They are tools that we can use to reach the beyond, or fingers pointing at the beyond, but they are not the beyond. We could say that the teachings of the Dharma are like a map. They're like a map that we can use to find our way to a much better place. We all have a map of reality in our heads. We all have a map, some sort of mental model of what the world is like, what life is like, and what we're doing within it. We all have that sort of map. And the Buddha saw that the usual map that most of us have, that we use to guide how we live, was very, very faulty. Very, very faulty indeed, and leading us to some not very great places. And the Buddha, so he offered us the Dharma as a much better map, a much better map for finding our way through this existence, a much better way for getting to a better place. And okay, this map of the Dharma is not the territory that it represents. It is not the territory map. We don't want to have our nose so stuck in the map that we never see the scenery. And we don't want to think that because we can understand perfectly from our map how to get to, say, Bali, that we're actually in Bali. The map can tell us what it's like. The map cannot tell us what it's like to be in Bali. It can only tell us how we might get there. But we still need the map. The map is a much more accurate map than the one we usually use. And if we use a faulty map, we might set off for Bali and end up in Barnsley. I hope nobody's from Barnsley. So just because the map is not the territory that it represents, for heaven's sakes, let's not throw it away. Let's not throw it away. Let's not try and exist in some sort of wordless soup of the beyond, because it's not going to work for us. We need the map desperately. And the Buddha put this another way. The Buddha put it another way. He said that his teachings were a raft that we should use to take us to the other shore, to take us to the beyond. But he said that when we get there, well, we shouldn't carry the raft around with us. The raft was a tool we used to get there. And it would be very stupid to then carry it around. But it would be even more stupid to jump off the raft in the middle of the river, because you're going to drown. And people do. People in my experience have drowned through jumping off the raft in the middle of the river. So if we understand that, it can be very, very dangerous. If it persuades us to abandon the teachings of Buddhism and just try to wallow in some wordless reality. So we take on Buddhist ideas and practices and throw ourselves into them wholeheartedly. The teachings of Buddhism may not be ultimately true, but they're an awful lot more true than our current conditioned opinions that we cling on to very tightly and base our actions upon, normally, quite unthinkingly. We don't even know we've got our current faulty map very often. Then So then the sutra, having sort of tried to give us this sort of stereo vision about even the teachings of the Dharma, that we use them, but we, in a sense, we see through them. The sutra goes on in Khonsa's version. Therefore, Sariputra, because of his non-attainment, having relied on transcendental wisdom, a bodhisattva lives without mental hindrances. Without mental hindrances, he is fearless and imperturbable. He is beyond upside-down views, and he attains nirvana. So the Pranyaparamita Sutras delight in paradox. And here we've got an example of their paradoxes. In the first line it says, therefore, Shariputra, because of his non-attainment. And the last bit says, he attains nirvana. Because of his non-attainment, he attains. One of the great paradoxes that the Pranyaparamita Sutras delight in, the first line points out, it points out one of the great koans or paradoxes of a spiritual life. Because of his non-attainment, he attains nirvana. Spiritual development is, you could say it's all about selflessness. It's about going beyond the limited small self, so that something higher can manifest. This selflessness means that we don't just pursue our own self-referential goals. But wanting attainment is a self-referential goal. If we want to get enlightened as an individual, for me, if I want to get enlightened for me, because it's good for me, well, I can't get enlightened because I'm still focusing on me. The means contradicts the ends somehow. We have to stop wanting anything for ourselves to get enlightened. But human beings need desire and purpose to act. Unless we want to grow and develop, we're not going to practice. We're not going to do the practices that lead to growth. So what on earth can we do? What on earth can we do? We're stuck with this catch-22, this koan. Actually, this apparent paradox doesn't really matter that much at our level, it has to say. For a long time to come, we can make a lot of progress by seeking enlightenment, by our own efforts, because we passionately want to be more than we are now, because we're in love with the ideal, because we see our potential and want to move towards it. We can make a lot of progress in that way. If we don't have this, what's called Dharma Chanda, this desire, this fascination for growth, we won't get far at all. But at the same time, we should be aware of getting too fixated or pumped up about our attainment. It's just more ego. It's just more ego. It's just more of what stops us. So we should not get too pumped up or fixated about our attainment. We should try to get ourselves out of the way as much as possible. Try as much as possible to bring an element of altruism and service into our practice, to make it more about others as much as about ourselves. And one of the other things I think about this is that we should really beware of other people when they claim spiritual attainments for themselves. There's another famous Pranyaparamita text, the Diamond Sutra, that tells us that anyone who thinks they're a stream entrant, for example, cannot possibly be a stream entrant. Presumably because they're still focused on themselves and their own attainments. Just a word of warning. So then the sutra that we chant goes on. So know that the bodhisattva, holding to nothing whatever, is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. As we've heard, everything around us is this insubstantial pageant, the shapes formed by clouds in the sky. And when we try to hold on to it, cling to it, fix it, full of our anxiety to fix it and make it safe and permanent and to match our ideas and the things we want out of it, make it the way it should be according to our ideas, we're constantly frustrated, constantly dissatisfied, constantly even in pain, and afraid. And afraid because what's going to happen? It's all so difficult to control. We're not in control. How terrifying is that? So the Bodhisattva holds on to nothing whatever, holding to nothing whatever. They play within the play of the cloudscape, very seriously trying to help themselves and others to be free from suffering, but sitting light to this play of stuff going on. And then they are free from delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it. So, all Buddhas of past and present, Buddhas of future time, using this prajna wisdom, come to full and perfect vision. Or in Khonsa's translation, all the Buddhas of the past, present and future completely wake up to full and perfect enlightenment by relying on the perfection of wisdom. That's pretty explicit. That's pretty explicit. This is the way to do it. This is the way to do it. Even if we seem to be following a different path, it has to have this the essentials of this path. It has to involve perfect wisdom. We may use different metaphors, tell different stories, but in the end it needs to be going in to the same place. All Buddhas of past and present, Buddhas of future time. And then to conclude the sutra, we usually chant, "Hear then the great Dharani, the radiant, peerless mantra, the Prajna Paramita, whose words allay all pain. Hear and believe its truth." Khonsa's translation goes like this: "Therefore know that the Prajna Paramita is the great mantra, the great mantra of knowledge, the uttermost mantra, the mantra that is like no other, the cure for all suffering, the truth. What could possibly go wrong?" It goes like this: "Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha." So, gate, gate. Yeah, and then this is the very heart of perfect wisdom. This mantra is the very heart of perfect wisdom. The ultimate condensation of the Heart Sutra, which is the condensation of this whole tradition of wisdom teachings, is not an intellectual formulation. It's not some metaphysical principle or philosophical statement. It's a mantra. Having shown that our intellectual understandings are the map and not the territory, Avalokiteshvara points us towards a different way of knowing, a way of knowing that has more to do with intuition, imagination, heart knowledge than intellectual understanding. We need to use our intellect. It's not saying we don't use our intellect, but we use our intellect to take us as far as we can go. We need to know the limits of the intellect. We need to know that to go further than that, we need other faculties. To know in the spiritual field, really know, we need to open up to mystery. The idea that we don't know, admitting that the universe is beyond our usual understanding, opening up to spiritual forces that maybe we can't understand, but which are beyond us. Forces that we can even see as higher beings that we could connect with, like Prajna Paramita. So mantras put us in touch with spiritual forces. This one puts us in touch with the wisdom of the beyond itself. Khonsa in Buddhist Wisdom Book says, because you are potentially a Buddha yourself, and because Avalokiteshvara in his compassion would not allow you to perish or despair, he will find a way to bridge the gap between your present state on the one hand and Prajna Paramita on the other. Avalokiteshvara, known traditionally as the bestower of mantras, has therefore given us a wonder-working mantra in which the perfection of wisdom is condensed. This is the mantra that goes gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. We could translate it as gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. What an awakening. All is well. This is the very heart of perfect wisdom.